Yes, sir.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Arroyo Grande, for Tuesday, October the 12th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Reynolds.
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens.
Here.
Councilmember Costello.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin.
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Here. The council just adjourned from closed session, and during the closed session, we had the opportunity to discuss a personnel matter, more specifically, the hiring of our new finance director. And at this time, I have the pleasure of introducing Ms. Angela Pillow. Angela, if you'll please stand up. Angela is the newest member of our team, and I'd like to welcome her to the city and to the community, and we're looking forward to working a lot with you. Get used to watching this the staff desk up here, so welcome. That will take us to item number three. Our flag salute this evening will be led by Boy Scout Troop 489. And if you would please remain standing, the invocation this evening will be given by Pastor George Lepper from the Peace Lutheran Church here in Arroyo Grande.
Let us pray. Father in heaven, we do thank and praise you for this day, for this time, for the sunshine and the weather. We ask to be with our city this evening as it goes about its business. Help us, Lord, to make wise decisions. Bless our council, bless our city. Be especially, Lord, with our fire department and our city, our police officers and all our city workers. Guide and protect them as they serve our community. Help us also, Lord, to find peace and bring our soldiers home and guide and protect them and those who serve overseas. Be especially, Lord, with our president at this time and the Congress. Help them to make wise decisions. Lord, also help us to work together to continue to make this city a better place to live. We pray, Lord, in the name of our personal Lord and Savior. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor. That will take us to item number five, special presentations. We have two this evening, and I will step down from the dais and make those presentations. First of all, it's good that Troop 489 is here in the front row because the first proclamation, the special presentation this evening, is an honorary proclamation recognizing Character Counts Week, October 17th through the 23rd, 2004. And I would like to ask Troop 489, the representative, to step forward. Representatives, gentlemen, welcome again, and thank you for the flag salute. It was great. And I want to read this proclamation at this time. Whereas young people will be the stewards of our communities, nation, and the world in critical times, and the present and future well-being of our society requires an involved, caring citizenry with good character. And whereas more than ever, children need strong and constructive guidance from their families and their communities, including schools, youth organizations, religious institutions, civic groups, and whereas the character of a nation is only as strong as the character of its individual citizens. And the public good benefits when young people learn that good character counts in personal relationships, in school, and in the workplace. And whereas scholars and educators agree that people do not automatically develop good character, and therefore conscientious efforts must be made by youth-influencing institutions and individuals to help young people develop the essential traits and characteristics that comprise good character. And whereas character development is first and foremost an obligation of families through efforts by faith communities, schools, and youth, civic, and human service organizations also play a very important role in supporting family efforts by fostering and promoting good character. And whereas an effective character education is based on core ethical values, which form the foundation of a democratic society, trustworthiness, respect, responsibility, fairness, caring, and citizenship. And these six pillars of character transcend cultural, religious, and socioeconomic differences. And whereas the character and the conduct of our youth reflect the character and conduct of our society, therefore every adult has the responsibility to teach and model the core ethical values, and every social institution has the responsibility to promote the development of good character. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, mayor of the city of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the city council and the citizens of Arroyo Grande, do hereby proclaim the week of October 17 through 23, 2004, as Character Counts Week, and do hereby endorse the six pillars of character and encourage all citizens, corporate and individual, to model these traits of good character in an ongoing commitment to promote character development and ethical behavior in the youth of our community. So it's my pleasure to present this at this time, and who will accept it? Good. Thank you very much.
We thank the city of Arroyo Grande for recognizing that character counts, because our children need the ability to understand the difference between right and wrong, and to have the strength of character to make the right choices. Our schools teach the skills and knowledge, but as Martin Luther King stated, intelligence is not enough. Intelligence plus character, that is the true goal of education. To help our children reach their full potential, we must teach them to be kind, responsible, honest, and self-disciplined. These important values are first learned in the family, but all of us have an obligation to support parents in the character education of our children. By guiding children to understand universal values such as respect, tolerance, compassion, and commitment to family and community, and by sustaining these shared values and passing them on to our children, we can realize our common hope for a more just and honorable society and a brighter future for generations to come. Once again, I thank the city.
Thank you. Thank you. At this time, I would like to ask Linda Nelson, the Red Ribbon Coordinator for Drug and Alcohol Services, to come forward. Welcome, Linda.
Good to see you.
And this evening, we also have an honorary proclamation recognizing Red Ribbon Week, October 23rd through 31st, 2004. And I'll read it at this time. Whereas tobacco, alcohol, and other drug use and abuse represents a serious public health and safety threat in Arroyo Grande, San Luis Obispo County, California, and throughout the United States. And whereas it is important for communities, schools, and individuals throughout San Luis Obispo County to work together to eliminate the demand for these substances and to promote programs that support a commitment to a healthy, drug-free lifestyle. And whereas the Red Ribbon celebration will be observed across the United States during Red Ribbon Week, October 23 through 31, 2004. And whereas parents, youth, government, business, law enforcement, schools, religious institutions, service organizations, social services, health services, media, and the general public will demonstrate their commitment to drug-free communities by wearing and displaying red ribbons during this observance. And whereas Red Ribbon Week highlights local substance abuse prevention programs that involve 7,500 youth and 7,000 parents yearly through local community coalitions and numerous countywide organizations such as Friday Night Live, DUI Prevention Task Force, the Slow Substance Abuse Prevention Alliance, and Slow County Drug and Alcohol Services. And whereas the City of Arroyo Grande further commits resources to ensure the success of the Red Ribbon Celebration and year-round tobacco, alcohol, and other drug prevention efforts, and whereas Red Ribbon Week 2004 will be highlighted by free activity-filled celebrations, the annual cheer competition and school posters, essay contests, and civic action throughout the county. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby support October 23rd through 31, 2004 as Red Ribbon Week, and encourage all citizens to participate in tobacco, alcohol, and other drug prevention activities, making a visible commitment to healthy communities in which to raise a generation of drug-free youth, and to the following, and to the follow the Red Ribbon Pledge, no use of illegal drugs and no illegal use of legal drugs. That's a mouthful. So it's my pleasure this evening to present this to you, and we would like to welcome you to say a few words about Red Ribbon.
Our big celebration starts on Saturday, October 23rd, in Meadow Park. We're going to have a cheerleading competition. We have over 25 cheerleading teams signed up to compete against each other. We also will have a fun day of Kids Day in the park with different venues for kids, leading to safety and healthy lifestyles. We also will end the week with a Mayor's Red Ribbon Sock Hop, which will be at McCarthy Wholesale on Friday night at 7 p.m. And we have a special offer that the mayor who comes and dances for the contest, we will give $1,000 to the charity of his choice, donated by Coast Federal Credit Union. So it's quite an incentive to get you to come out there and shake a little boogie. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you. It would take about $5,000 to get me out on that. Okay. That takes us to item 6 this evening, agenda review. Move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. Roll call. I'm sorry. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. Takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for any member of the public to come forward with any suggestions or observations that are within the boundary of the council's authority. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking formal action on any matter that is not published on the agenda, and we would ask that your comments and observations this evening be restricted to those items that are not on this evening's agenda. If there's any member of the public that would like to come forward at this time, please address the council as a whole and try and limit your comments to 3 minutes or less. Anyone who would like to come forward? Couldn't tell if you're walking all the way up or here we go.
Good evening, gentlemen. My name is Nancy Castle. I'm with AGP Video, and on behalf of the Arroyo Grande Chamber of Commerce, the League of Women Voters, and the Five Cities and Pismo Beach AAUW, I'd like to invite all of you that aren't running for election this year to come to the campaign forum tomorrow night, October 13th, at the South County Regional Center, which is right next to the library at 800 West Branch Street. This is the first of three campaign forums that are being held by this group. October 14th, we'll see an assembly forum, which is Sam Blakesley, Tom Hutchings, and Stu Jenkins, and Gary Kirkland. October 18th, the State Senate District 15 will be having a forum, which is candidates Abel Maldonado and Peg Pinard. And I'm sure you're all familiar that tomorrow night the event will star Roa Grande Mayor candidates Tony Ferrara and Doug Jones and City Council candidates Ed Arnold, Fred Bauer, Jim Guthrie, and Gail Lightfoot. And AGP Video will be filming all three of these. They will be able to be seen on Channel 21, and the candidates, the Roa Grande Candidates Forum, will also be seen on the local Channel 20. So thank everybody, and remember to vote. Voting is November 2nd, and you have until October 18th to register to vote if you aren't so registered. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Items not on this evening's agenda. Okay, seeing no one else, we will close community comments and suggestions. That will take us to item number 8, which is our consent agenda. This is a group of items that the council has had an opportunity to review, and we generally approve these in one action unless there is a particular item on the consent agenda that a member of the council would like to pull for further discussion or independent action. What is the will of the council? Okay, no items this evening. If not, then I will entertain a motion for approval of consent items 8A through 8I.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. Anything to read in there, Tim, tonight? Okay, thanks. Roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin?
Yes.
Councilmember Runnels?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. That will take us to item number 9, public hearings. First item is 9A, consideration of a proposed ordinance repealing, amending, and adding provisions and titles to the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code. Kelly.
Thank you. Mayor Farrar and members of the City Council, before you tonight is the second in a series of proposed ordinances repealing, amending, and adding provisions to the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code. In 2003, staff initiated a comprehensive review and update process of the city's municipal code to ensure that code provisions comply and reflect the city's current policies and practices. Last year, Ordinance 547 was adopted by the City Council, which updated Titles 1, 2, and 3 of the municipal code. Earlier this year, staff implemented a review of the next series of titles, which included Title 5, dealing with business licenses and regulations, Title 6, which is the animals title, Title 8, health and safety, Title 9, public peace and welfare, and Title 10, vehicles and traffic. A majority of the amendments are minor in nature, dealing with grammatical and organizational changes, and have been outlined in your staff report and draft ordinance. However, there are a few substantive amendments that I'd like to highlight. During the review of Title 9, the Chief of Police submitted language to add comprehensive provisions regarding camping. Currently, a single provision in Title 12, Streets, Sidewalks, and Public Places, addresses overnight camping that is prohibited only in parks. This existing section in Title 12 is being recommended for repeal, and a new chapter proposed to be added to Title 9 that sets forth extensive provisions regarding overnight camping in more detail. The repeal of Section 12.20.020 is the only change to Title 12 reflected in the proposed ordinance. A review of Title 12 in its entirety will be completed in the next and last phase of this review process. Another substantive amendment to the code includes the update and relocation of existing chapters concerning dances and public entertainment activities and public exhibitions from Title 5, which is currently business license, to Title 9, public peace and welfare, so it more accurately reflects the chief's authority for issuing permits and enforcing the regulations for these specific events. If the proposed ordinance is introduced, it will return to the next meeting for adoption. Following that action, staff's next step will be to proceed with a comprehensive review of the remaining titles of the code. It should be noted that the Community Development Department, independent from this project, is in the process of updating Title 16, the Development Code, in accordance with state law to ensure consistency with the city's general plan. It is recommended that the council introduce the proposed ordinance repealing, amending, and adding provisions to Titles 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, and 12 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have in the proposed ordinance, and I'd like to point out that Chief Tabork is here and available to answer any questions that relate directly to the police department function, as those were most of the amendments in this ordinance. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Are there questions, clarifications in the staff report? Mayor Pro Tem?
I have a question, Chief, or Kelly, whoever. Section 9.04.010, you're repealing that section, which is solicitors and peddlers declaration of nuisances. You're stating in here that it's unconstitutional. Can you maybe give me some background on that?
Actually, the city attorney may be able to quote the cases, but several years ago, both the state Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court struck down local ordinances prohibiting people from soliciting. That's basically what it is. We have not been enforcing this ordinance for several years because of its unconstitutionality.
Is this stating then that there's no way for us to have an ordinance to prohibit this in any fashion?
Correct. It's considered free speech.
We do regulate it through the business license process, yeah. But we can't prohibit the actual process of solicitation.
Yeah. And that aspect is also important because if somebody complains, if we at least have a permit on file, we know who the person is and we can go out and investigate the incident. What we don't want is when peddlers come into town that may live somewhere else and we get complaints, and if there's no permit or anything, they're off and we can't track them down or find, you know, investigate the problems in any way.
Yeah.
So that alone is very valuable to us in responding to citizen complaints.
Let me clarify that. If there's misbehavior on their part, obviously we can take action because there is law. But you cannot prohibit them from approaching a location to solicit.
Okay. Can I go back just a second? I got a little confused. Are you stating that each one is required to have a business license? And is that followed up on?
Except nonprofits like...
No, I'm talking about the guy at the corner who's got to work for food but has his hand out.
That is a whole separate situation, and they do not come under solicitors, peddlers, what have you. In fact, I have been researching a potential ordinance to bring in front of you. In fact, this camping ordinance that you have tonight is part of the solution in dealing with that. And I can go into that further if you wish to discuss it. In terms of the homeless solicitor, per what we're talking about here, you cannot outlaw that per se. However, there are some provisions that I am currently looking at that I may be able to bring back to the council to help regulate that. For example, you may not solicit within 100 feet of a driveway to a commercial center or something like that. I am looking at that right now. There's a chance I can bring if the council so directs, I will bring that back to you. I would like to bring that back to you because we've had some problems because of that situation. But that's a different type of solicitor. They would not even have been involved in the old ordinance. The old ordinance dealt with solicitors going house to house basically to sell something.
Okay, thank you. I was a little confused on that, so thank you. That was my only question.
Any other questions? I have a couple. And before I ask them, I would like to emphasize the issue that the Mayor Pro Tem brought up. And I guess the whole issue for me is legitimacy, because we see, particularly up at Five City Center, we see all the driveways covered. We see signs that look remarkably as if they were drawn by this same person. And we see the same faces in some form of organization from site to site. And so you have to question, is this someone who is truly needy, or is this some form of a...
Oh, I can respond to that. You are absolutely correct. And it's just not Five City Center. It's Kmart Center. It's Spencer's. That particular center, it's been down, not so much a cookie crock, but they have been a cookie crock. It is the same group. It is about a dozen people. They were run out of Pismo Beach several months ago on an issue over camping and some other things. And they've ended up in our city, and they have been located in some interesting places, which we're trying to address tonight, partly with the camping ordinance. And like I said, as soon as I can finish researching this other, I'll be more than happy to bring it back, because I've been looking at a way to intervene with this particular problem. But I can tell you the people of this community are being ripped off because some of these people are making $200 plus a day in these donations. And my advice to anybody that's listening to this broadcast tonight, as well as anybody in the audience, these are professional panhandlers that make good money at this. And the only way we can get rid of them, besides maybe some legal issues, some legal prodding, is for people not to fall for their scam, because it is a scam. This is an absolute scam. People are making big money on this.
On page 2, and I'll just toss this out. Steve, you might be able to chime in on this one as well. The last bullet says add section 10.36.022, wheeled toys. And it's primarily for skateboarding. I understand the direction for that, but there are a couple of other issues. You tell me if this is a place that can umbrella the issues that that I have concerns about. One, I think we have the issue resolved. It's remote control vehicles in parking lots and that emit high noise levels, so on and so forth. The other has to do with, and I'm certain that this probably doesn't umbrella this issue, but if you look at our reasonably new bulb outs and benches where we have stamped concrete, colored concrete that looks very nice, with the exception of the fact that many of them are lined with tire skid marks because for some reason or other kids drive their ride their bikes over it and then slam on the brakes and skid right across that colored concrete. So much so that it's in many places, particularly along Grand Avenue, it looks very unsightly. In any way that any of these ordinances can address those two?
The answer to your first question is no, in terms of this does not involve the remote-controlled vehicles. This involves wheel toys, meaning bicycles, skateboards, those types of toys, inline skates, that kind of those kind of toys. It does not involve remote-controlled vehicles. The purpose of this ordinance to begin with, or this revision, was that the current ordinance is extremely confusing because it talks about reckless use, but it combines in it, and its wording is very difficult, the issue about prohibited skateboarding on private property. So what we've done is taken the private property section, made it a separate ordinance, so it is very clear that an owner of private property has the ability to make the declaration to prohibit these types of activities on that property. Along with what you're saying, yes, the ordinance in terms of reckless skateboarding or reckless whatever could apply to what you're doing. The problem is seeing it happen at the time. For example, the other day, Saturday, I happened to be going over to the Bank of America, and I put the habeas corpus on three kids that were skateboarding off the top and into the street. In the same group had been told not to do this before. And I just happened to be out there, and I told them one more time, and I'll seize your skateboards, and you'll get tickets, and they're $25, yada, yada, yada. Didn't see them for the rest of the day, at least. But that kind of thing is what the ordinances cover. So somebody driving down the sidewalk, slamming on the brakes, skidding over, riding, flipping their skateboards up onto the benches like they do, that is covered under the original section as reckless skateboarding currently. The thing is, we have to see it happen in order to be able to deal with it.
Okay. And I understand that the particular situation with the remote control vehicles is being addressed under the conditional use permit for that area.
Yeah, we believe it's been resolved. They have been notified that we did not classify that as a use that's allowed under their conditional use permit.
Okay. I had a question on page 5. Under section U, it says amend section 8.3.2050.B. The clearing of waste matter, debris, and vehicles from private property. What I'm gathering from this correction is that somebody made a determination that the ordinance should not contain a notice to remove exemplar. Is that where this is going?
That's correct. I think in our ordinance 473, it calls out the format of the notice, and it doesn't need to actually be in the code, and it could be by statute also, government code.
Okay. So we don't need to have it here. Okay, my last question is for you, Chief. And it has to do with adding, it's on page 11, has to do with adding chapter 9.22, which Kelly talked about, camping. And down at the bottom, it's 9.22.020, prohibition. And I'm sorry, it's 030, exceptions. And then if you go over to the top of page 12, it says limited overnight camping or overnight occupancy of a recreational vehicle may be permitted subject to the approval of the chief of police. Such limited overnight camping and or recreational vehicle use shall be for a maximum of 5 days. So I'm guessing or I'm asking what instances would fall under this.
Well, we have the Rock and Gym Show, for example, that's held once or twice a year at Arroyo Grande High School. People stay there in their vehicles. Technically, right now, it's illegal. We have the some of the antique shows and things like that up at the Women's Center where people have stayed there. Technically, that's currently illegal. And this would give me the authority to make exemptions for those specific events that are basically community activities. During Strawberry Festival, we have some of that, too, that in the past, it's been technically illegal, but we're trying to accommodate the event and the people coming in for the event. So we've basically allowed it. This will justify what we're doing.
That's fine. And I guess my only observation would be it would probably be good on that exception section if we could put in a few examples of what those exceptions might be, community-related activities such as something along those lines. And just give a couple of examples so that we understand what those exceptions are. That would be my only comment there. Okay.
Can I ask a question
sure.
on that?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Rick, would under that exception, then what about the overnight guest or that's going to park on the street with their RV for 3 nights because they came in from Idaho?
Okay, that is already permitted in the code, and there are no changes being suggested for that. In fact, I think we had a statement in here that except as provided in, I'll have to go back to it.
Title 10.
Title 10.28020 and 10.28040. Those permit that for a limited stay, and there are no changes in that. That's why we reference it.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up. Any other? Yes.
Rick, also on that, there are certain times when some of these produce trucks get in late and whatnot and don't have a place to go. Are they going to be exempt from that also or come under the same rules?
Actually, right now they can't. We try to be reasonable about that, but technically right now under the current ordinance they cannot do that, and this really wouldn't change that. But on the other hand, we have not been known to run them out of town.
Well, like along traffic way in a commercial area, there's plenty of times when that does happen for somebody to get there at midnight and got to wait a while. So, okay. That's all.
Anything else? Okay. This is a public hearing. If there are members of the audience who would like to come forward and comment on 9A, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. Okay. Seeing none. Close public comment, bring this back. Councilmember Runnels, why don't you start us off on this one?
I have no problem with it, Mr. Mayor. It appears that this is going to be cleanup language to make things a little more up to speed, and so I'm ready to move forward with it.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Mr. Mayor, yeah, I too have no issues with the item before us and would support moving for approval as presented.
Okay. Councilmember Costello.
I can echo my associates' comments. I find that all this cleans up language that needs to be cleaned up. I don't think there's anything objectionable to it. It makes it clearer, easier to enforce, and I think it's right, and let's go forward with it.
Good. Mayor Pro Tem?
I have no comments. Let's move forward.
Okay. I concur.
Mr. Mayor, if I can, you've asked us for some language on this one section so that you can adopt this tonight or approve this tonight. How about something to the effect, limited overnight camping or overnight occupancy of a recreational vehicle may be permitted for designated community activities. Obviously, we'll have to designate them, subject to the approval of.
Mm-hmm. Sure, and list a couple of them. Yeah.
Well, they can change, and we know what they basically are, and
that's
having some confidence
that's
in the
fine.
Chief.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's fine.
No. Okay. No
You're
confidence
asking us
in the
to have
chief.
Confidence in you. Okay. Sure. That language is fine with me if it's okay with everybody else. And with that, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move we adopt an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Royal Grande repealing, amending, and adding provisions to Titles 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, and a portion of Title 12 of the Royal Grande Municipal Code, including the language that was just submitted by the Chief.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Runnels?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, thank you. That takes us to item 9B. This is our second public hearing. Consideration of interpretation of allowable uses within the composition of the agricultural buffer overlay district.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, Councilman. Unfortunately, Kelly Heffernan, who prepared your staff report, is out ill with a very serious back problem. So Jim Bergman is here to give the staff report for the buffers.
Thank you, Teresa. Thank you, Mayor, Council members. Tonight, staff is seeking clarification on the agricultural buffer provisions as stated as in Ordinance 550. Staff has received several subjective questions from potential applicants related to the buffer provisions. Buffer language appeared in the agricultural conservation and open space element of the 2001 general plan. Language related to buffers was discussed in the agricultural conservation study, which was presented to the Planning Commission and the City Council. In addition, general plan buffer policies were implemented through Ordinance 550 in December 2003. Language about buffers was specific to each document. In the general plan, it provides specific yet flexible and carefully worded statements related to the establishment of agricultural buffers within the city. Care was taken in this document to avoid prescribing design solutions or excessive criterion that would prevent reasonable use of property. In the agriculture conservation study, buffer types were identified, including physical and spatial. The report also emphasized buffer use beyond just pesticide applications, for example, helping to mitigate noise, dust, water, human intrusion, crop pilferage, nuisance animals. In essence, it's showing that a buffer could be used to create good neighbors between agricultural uses and urban uses. The report also stated challenges such as maintenance responsibilities that are associated with buffers. And lastly, it analyzed the number of new non-conforming properties that would be created with varying buffer distances. From those discussions, the City Council passed Ordinance 550, which created an Agricultural Preservation Overlay District, AG 2.2. This buffer district spoke to only new uses, such as subdivision of land, use permits, and building permits for new residential uses. It placed a perimeter overlay district of 100 feet around agriculturally zoned properties for the purpose of addressing the agricultural urban interface. Essentially, it's a map that shows a 100-foot agricultural buffer around all agricultural properties in order to inform people that there are agricultural operations within the city. In addition, Ordinance 550 amended parts of the right to farm provisions, and specifically it requires that all new developments adjacent to any designated agricultural district provide an agricultural buffer. It states that the buffer should be a minimum of 100 feet. It's encouraged to be bigger, although smaller size would be allowed if there's an existing and adequate physical buffer, such as Arroyo Grande Creek. It also states that the buffer should be composed of a 20-foot-wide agricultural landscape transition area contiguous to the 80-foot-wide agricultural buffer adjacent to the designated agricultural district. It states that permitted uses within the buffer are native plants, trees or hedgerows, roads, drainage channels, storm retention ponds, natural areas such as creeks or drainage swales, utility corridors, storage, and any use consistent with an agricultural buffer as determined by the Planning Commission. It also stated restrictions to the buffer, and it states that no new residential uses shall be permitted within the buffer area unless it is determined there would be no other economically viable use of the property. And it also addressed buildings that may have been damaged to be restored, and it stated that it could be restored under Section 1648.110 of the Municipal Code. With that, the issues tonight that staff would like some clarification on are, one, allowable uses, are backyards for new residential uses and associated accessory structures such as sheds or attached or detached garages considered an allowable use in an agricultural buffer? And what is considered storage? Second, that deals with the location of the landscape strip, is must a transitional 20-foot landscape area be placed immediately adjacent to the 80-foot-wide buffer area, or can it be placed anywhere within the 100-foot buffer? The Planning Commission discussed this item, and they recommended more flexibility to be allowed regarding the location of the 20-foot landscape buffer, but no consensus was reached on whether non-habitable accessory residential structures, detached or attached garages, should be allowed within the buffer area. This is my report. Teresa and I are here to field questions. Thank you.
Are there questions of the staff report, clarifications?
I have one, Mr. Mayor.
Okay.
For whichever one of you care to answer this, if and when these buffers are implemented, with 100 feet or 50 feet or 200 feet, wherever it may wind up, who is going to be responsible for keeping the weeds and the noxious things out of it and the pests that go along with it? Is it going to be the adjacent agricultural operator, or is it going to be the homeowner, or is the city going to take on another quasi park to take care of?
Councilman Reynolds, there's a distinction that we need to make sure we're clear on. The overlay district, this is the mapping notice. When a new project comes along that requires a buffer, then that's going to be determined in the project review. And we could not prescribe a single scenario that we don't know would fit to every new project coming forward. So we put that there has to be a provision for maintenance. And the mechanism for that has to be approved by the approving body. But to prescribe whether it's a homeowners association or a maintenance district or what have you, that has to be part of that project's review.
Because at the present time, any buffers that have been left voluntarily are just left voluntarily, and there's no one who takes care of it unless the adjacent property owner is conscientious enough to try to keep the pest out of his field in order to take care of it. So I think that in the city where some of these buffers are in existence, there is a problem as far as pests go.
Yeah, that is a key issue. And like Teresa said, the options are there. It's probably going to come down to the development establishing an HOA to maintain that area, which, and depending on what the determination here, could be a fairly extensive area. Otherwise, the city would have to get involved, hopefully through an assessment district where we would have to agree to take that over and maintain it.
But unfortunately, at the present time, the governmental entities are the ones that are the worst offenders of it.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I do have a question, and I guess we might as well get into it before we do public comment. Once the overlay is placed and the definitions are established, could you define for me what I'm thinking about is the legally nonconforming residence that is affected by the addition of the overlay? And for the sake of discussion, we'll say a remodel that would add to the existing residence. And there's two different ways to look at it. One, that would add to the residence that would encroach farther into the 100-foot, or add to the residence that would be on the opposite side of the 100-foot. So is there a distinction there?
The ordinance as written and as discussed in the public hearing process does not affect existing residential use adjacent to agricultural designated lands. And that scenario whereby a residence that is in the buffer area or even right next to the buffer area can expand their residential use as much as they want, it really applies only to new residential uses. So this would really, of course, targets new subdivision. It does affect properties that are already established next to an ag-designated district. If they want to establish a second residential unit, perhaps, that would, and that would only be if it would be in the buffer area. So they can have their second residential unit on the property clear of the buffer area, but not in the buffer area, then it would be kicked up into discretionary review.
Okay, I understand that, but I want to make sure I heard you correctly in determining. It seems a fine line when you say new residential uses. So if I have a three-bedroom home and I make it a four-bedroom home through a remodel, I have added a new residential use for one bedroom.
No, that's not.
Can that be interpreted that way?
No, not as defined in the ordinance. You can have an eight-bedroom home. It is not a new residential use until you...
Okay, so let me take it to the far extreme then. We have this three-bedroom home, and the owner decides they want to really expand, and the expansion eats up 50 or 75 feet of the 100-foot buffer. That would be okay as long as they're remodeling the existing home.
That's correct.
Okay, one more step on that then. We've seen remodels where the only thing left is maybe the fireplace or one wall, and then the whole other portions of the house have been rebuilt. How does that affect it if one were to take advantage of that process?
There is a cutting point. Normally it's 50%. In other words, if they're using it to de facto create a new home, and that's usually pretty apparent from the application, obviously it would trigger the buffer requirements. If this is a genuine good faith remodel, and it's normally, 50% in terms of expansion is, and I was looking through our code because I know it's defined in there at a certain point, and the break point usually is beyond that. If your remodel, in quotes, includes expanding the size of your home, say, by more than 50%, that would normally be considered a new home, not a new residential use, but a new home, and that would trigger the buffer.
But it is conceivable that you could have a more than 50% remodel, which is a true remodel. We just had one down the street from me, okay, that went from 2,300 to 5,000 square feet, which is more than that's more than 100%. Okay, so what portion of – I guess what I want to do is just make sure that it's clear so that somebody doesn't come in and say, this is what I want to do, and we're starting to scratch our head and say, well, it's an interpretation, and then we get into all this he said, she said things. So,
any other clarifications, comments?
One more, Mr. Mayor.
Sure.
I know that on Pike and Elm, we have a project scheduled, or it's been going through the process for some senior housing or affordable housing there. And that's across the street from an agricultural field. And the agricultural field is in the county, and this property is in the city. Now, how is that going to play with our 100-foot buffer?
I missed the first half of your question.
On Pike and Elm,
repeat it.
We have a project going through the process behind 7-Eleven where they're talking about some units in there, residential apartments or whatever. And there's an agricultural field right across the street from it. And you're talking about new versus nothing. And the agricultural field is in the county. Mm-hmm. Now, are we still going to enforce that, or are we going to let them build right up to the property line? Because there are other cases within the city that this scenario works on.
That's correct, and it does apply to the protection, essentially, of ag in and with and surrounding the city. That particular project did have to comply with a 100-foot buffer.
So they moved off and lost a percentage of what they had.
Yes, they did.
Any other comments? If not, this is a public hearing. If there are any members of the audience who would like to come forward and comment on 9B, this would be an opportunity.
My name is Anthony Azevedo. I have a few dumb questions to ask here. One, in establishing a buffer, an ag buffer, as I understand, what you are doing is seizing control of adjacent properties, okay? Now, my notion, if you have ag land, the 100-foot buffer should be within the ag land if you're spraying or doing whichever. Now, what this does, individuals who have property adjacent ag operations are limited. Now, what it does is it downzones certain individuals' property. Now, is the city or somebody going to compensate those individuals for downzoning their property? I don't think so. So if you're adjacent this thing, you're going to lose. And I don't believe that that an ag operation, I don't know that farmland has been declared an endangered species, that we need to take these severe measures to protect or to help individuals at other people's expense. Now, I know of numerous parcels in the area by the imposition of this buffer. It wipes these people out. They can't do anything with their land. And it makes a lot of the properties substandard as far as lot size. And as I understand, you can go in and add to your home, but if your property is pretty much devoured by that 100-foot buffer and you may have 10 feet or 20 feet left over, what do you do then? I think that many of these things that are adopted or are reviewed or studied do not have the full consideration of everybody in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Hi. I'm Karen Estes, and I live on East Cherry. I have a question about the legality. We were sent a notice of public hearing, and there's one thing that I don't understand, and I'd like it explained by the city attorney. If you challenge an item in court, you may be limited to raising only those issues you or someone else raised at a public hearing described in this notice or in written correspondence delivered to the city council at or prior to the public hearing. You know, that's like walking into an office and they say, okay, here's your job. Do you have any questions? You've never done that work before. So, of course, it seems like they've explained everything to you till you start to do the job. And then you'll have questions. What this is telling me is that if in the future
I have a problem, and I didn't address that question to the city council. I don't have a leg to stand on if I challenge it in court. Am I misinterpreting this?
Maybe we could respond.
That's a doctrine that's conventionally known as the exhaustion of administrative remedies. And the policy behind that doctrine is that you give the decision makers the opportunity to understand what your problems are and fix them at that level, at the administrative level, legislative level here, before you're going to resort to the courts and what the court would deem it, waste the court's time. If you had an opportunity at a lower level to fix that problem, it would never have gone to court, and it wouldn't have wasted the resources that ultimately are paid by the taxpayers. So I understand that there can be permutations on that theory, but it's a very common practice that you should be here listening, reading the material, understanding it, bringing up your issues at this level so that if they are issues that need to be fixed, addressed, modified, refined, they can be done here. As opposed to never letting the decision makers know what that problem is, never allowing them the opportunity to fix it, and then running to court and wasting judicial resources to fix what could have been fixed at this level. And that's true at every level of government. So at the Architectural Review Commission level, if you could have been there, seen it, understood it, right on Planning Commission, City Council, you need to exhaust your remedies, and really what it begs for is participation at the lowest and earliest point in the process.
Okay. I did go to the Planning Commission, and I relayed a little story that agriculture is a business. It's nothing more than that. If I owned a car washing business and my spray from my car washing business hit my neighbor, I would be the one who would have to put up something to shield my neighbor from my overspray. And yet, farming is a business, and they are taking 100 feet of my property all along the farmland. I find this really strange that business has to do it, and yet farmers don't have to do that. And I find that very, very unfair.
Thank you. Anyone else? Would like to come forward.
Good evening. My name is Adam Sarvatari, and my family runs a commercial farming operation within the city of Arroyo Grande. It's existed for four generations. I am the fourth. Basically, what I wanted to say this evening is an agricultural buffer is an essential tool. I mean, our goal is to have a good working relationship with the community, but the things that come along with that operation are things that, you know, tend to not mix sometimes. I mean, there are good aspects and bad aspects of farming, but, you know, there has to be some medium to work together. A buffer is a tool that will allow us to continue to work together. I mean, I've heard a lot of the points raised tonight, and I understand there are concerns, but this operation, we're not changing our practices. So something that comes along, I mean, we're trying to just do our best to integrate within the community, but we haven't done anything differently. We're just staying essentially the same. We also have changed our practices greatly to try and accommodate the community by applying at all hours of the night. I mean, as you say, agriculture is a business. Well, my parents' farming operation as well has incurred a lot of cost to try and assist in developing a better relationship with the community. So I'd just like to say that I appreciate that the council is continually looking after the farming community. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Steve Ross, 211 Garden Street. I attended the Planning Commission meeting where a lot of these issues were addressed. The Planning Commission, at the Planning Commission level, there appeared to be a different take on expansion of nonconforming properties within the ag buffer. What I understood them to say was that if you had a home that was inside the ag buffer, you could remodel that and go up, but you couldn't, and you could go out away from the agricultural land, but you could not expand the house towards the agricultural land. And during the conversation, Planning Commission members extended that to uses in the backyard, like adding a deck or a patio. And they also did not feel that adding storage and garages was acceptable either. Tonight we're hearing, or I am hearing, a different scenario in that expansion could be made towards the ag land, and I would just like to make sure that I misunderstood what was going on at the Planning Commission or that the values have changed since that time. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to clarify that point, Teresa? Could you?
Sure. The point is the expansion into the of an existing residential use into the buffer area or exclusive of the buffer area. You know, the preference may be to keep it out of the buffer area, but there's nothing in the ordinance that precludes that. If it's not a new residential use, the ordinance does not wouldn't touch that, an expansion into the buffer area.
Thank you. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
Council, Carol Huffmeyer, representative for the Dixon Ranch. On the two issues that the Planning Commission has put forward to the council tonight, my comments are the 20-foot landscaping, the minimum 20-foot landscaping buffer, farmers would prefer that to be as far away from their crops as possible because the landscaping brings in birds and critters which eat the crops. So if we could just move that as far away from the crops as possible, that would be the best for farmers. The other issue of backyards and garages being within that buffer, they really don't need to be in the buffer because children play in backyards. People are out working in their garages, and with the dust and the noise and the pesticides that are sprayed, they don't need to be within that buffer. They need to be outside of that buffer area. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, seeing no one, we will close public comment on item 9B and bring this back. Councilmember Costello, why don't you start this one?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We talk about the agricultural buffer, and I guess staff wants to get some clarification on some of these issues. And I want to go back to the whole intent behind the agricultural buffer. It comes under our code and section 16.12.170, the right to farm provision. And the purpose and intent of that is to protect agricultural land uses and designations identified on the general plan and zoning map from conflict with non-agricultural uses that may result in financial hardship to agricultural operators or the termination of their operation, and to promote a good neighbor policy between agriculturalists and residents. Okay. My understanding of that and my belief that what the agricultural buffer should do, and this is for new residential development only, and I don't define a remodel of a house, an existing use of a piece of property that's already been developed. I don't consider that to be new development. I prefer that garages and backyards not be in the buffer zone. Now, for an existing piece of property that's already there, I guess if they want to put a storage shed or a garage in that buffer, that's within what the code specifies. And my understanding of that would be the resident of that building or that property lives next to the farm. They know what's going on. They have an understanding of what they're involved with. But certainly I don't think that new residential development, we should allow sheds or garages to be placed in that buffer zone. I think that they should be outside of that buffer zone. And I would think that it would be more effective in terms of the 20-foot separation, the 20-foot planted area, to be as close to the residential portion rather than close to the agricultural operation, simply because it would be a better screen by being closer to the houses that it's supposed to be sheltering or supposed to be buffering. So my preference would be that the 20-foot part of the buffer should be closer to the residential area than to the farm, the agricultural uses. In terms of the maintenance side of it, and I'm not completely certain I understand the ins and outs of it for the existing uses, certainly if a new project comes forward, we're going to see some sort of maintenance district put in place. There'll be some sort of mechanism in place to take care of that problem, and that makes sense to me. I guess I've got a question for how that will affect existing properties and how we're going to maintain that buffer, and I don't have a solution for that. I'm open to hear what other suggestions and recommendations come forward. But in terms of the two issues for allowable uses, I think we should not permit garages and storage sheds in that buffer zone. And I think the landscaping strip should be closer to the closer to the residential property or the non-agricultural property rather than close to the agricultural property. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Before I get started with some of my comments specifically on staff's report here, I would like to make note that I'll provide this to staff, but in my research in regards to agricultural buffers and what's out there, and I know staff has provided us with a number of different policies this evening from different jurisdictions and so forth, but probably the best planning guidelines that I've found actually comes out of the Department of Natural Resources out of Queensland in Australia. And let me just read a couple things, because I think that this particular, what they've done here is they've actually quantified the different conflicts that exist and scientifically have put together specific distances and potential buffer elements, as you may, that could actually assist in reducing the impacts of these two land uses. And what I'd like to start out with is, first of all, is they have some principles, and I think it may address some of the comments that were brought up by the public this evening. Let me just read this as principles 1.13. The planning guidelines should be applied with the considerations to the following principles. One, provided agricultural practices are legally practiced according to existing codes of practice, it is unreasonable for new adjacent uses to demand a modification of these practices to an extent which threatens efficient agricultural operations. Two, when preparing planning schemes, local government should avoid, as far as practical, locating residential development in close proximity to agricultural land. Where this is not possible, mechanisms such as buffer areas should be used to minimize conflicts. Three, buffer areas should be determined on the basis of the sustainable agricultural use, land use, with the potential to have the most impact on adjacent land use and which is reasonably likely to be practiced regardless of current use. Four, buffer areas should be located within the site being developed for residential purposes and be provided, funded by the proponent of that development. This principle protects the prior rights of agricultural producers to practice agriculture on rural lands. And five, where conflicts already exist between agricultural and residential land uses, mechanisms including mediation, source controls, and public education should be encouraged. And I think those are principles that I would certainly like to promote, and I believe that the ordinance that's before us, or the ordinance that we've already actually adopted, is attempting to actually monitor and reflect those particular principles. As it relates this evening, as I read the buffer ordinance, the way I look at it is a little bit differently, and in regards to what I've heard thus far this evening, And there's been a lot of attention placed on this 100-foot buffer. And the attention is rightly so because there's a lot of language in our ordinance that talks about the minimum 100-foot agricultural buffer. And we tend to get stuck on that. But I believe that as you read through the ordinance, the minimum is simply that. It's a minimum. And the ordinance does have some very specific criteria as to what's allowable within the minimum 100-foot buffer. But it's important to note that the ordinance actually prescribes in E-2, that optimally buffers wider than 100 feet should be encouraged. And from my feedback, this is what I'll what I would like to, at least the way I interpret the current language, is first of all, is that staff should be encouraging greater distances than 100 feet. That's what the ordinance suggests, that we don't just say, well, let's start at 100 and see how we can whittle it down. We need to be looking at the fact that what is the optimal buffer in any given situation. In relations to the language, I think that it would be helpful for clarification purposes when we look at section 16.12.170 that as we start off, we basically talk about the criteria as laid out. And basically, it starts out by saying the city has determined that the use of property for agricultural operations is a high priority. Okay. All new development adjacent to any designated agricultural districts shall be required to provide an agricultural buffer. And what I think we're getting stuck with, and I think we ought to stick with the language that is in the actual section, is it talks about development as used in this section means subdivision of land, use permits, and building permits for new residential units, not uses. It actually says units. And I think that helps clarify to me when we talk about some of the confusion as to what I heard. And Mr. Ross, I was at the Planning Commission meeting, and I was confused as well because there is some misinterpretation, I believe. But I would like to echo, and at least from my point of view, is we're really talking about new residential units. We're not talking about existing residents and their use of their property to remodel and such that we've already discussed this evening. And then we get into under the ordinance, we get into specific criteria, and it says that the buffer shall be a minimum of 100 feet. And, of course, that is measured from the designated agricultural district, i.e. agricultural property line. And then, again, it says optimally to achieve a maximum separation, a buffer wider than 100 feet is encouraged. And then it talks about a decreased buffer distance may be allowed if it can be demonstrated that a physical buffer exists that is adequate and approved by San Luis Obispo County Ag Commissioner. I would suggest that if indeed an applicant were to come forward and suggest that they can put together a buffer less than 100 feet, that we might be looking at some of the guidelines that are put in this particular document that actually scientifically document how you calculate noise, how you calculate drift, how you calculate odor, and those types of things. This is the only document that I've actually seen that you can put in a mathematical formula to those particular items, which takes the subjectiveness out of this whole issue. And I think that's the only way that we're going to be able to determine if a decreased buffer can be allowed less than 100 feet. Because if not, it's just going to be very subjective. We could certainly have adopted an ordinance that was very specific to this and required every applicant to come forth with basically hired consultants to do a similar to a traffic study, but an impact study on these particular issues. But I think that would be very costly to the individual, and I think it's unnecessary, which in my opinion is why I supported the buffer policy as presented. And then the buffer policy goes on to state that the minimum 100-foot buffer shall be comprised of two components, and such as the 20-foot wide agricultural landscape transition and the 80-foot wide agricultural buffer adjacent to the designated agricultural district, and so forth. In regards to specifically, the staff is asking a couple of very, very poignant questions tonight, and I think those are appropriate, and I appreciate the opportunity to at least share my opinion on this. What I would like to say is when we talk about the buffer, I'd like to identify, first of all, are we talking about the minimum buffer? Because the minimum buffer is designated as 100 feet. And within that 100 feet, it says specifically that there, you know, let me go back to this, that, let's see, it says no portion of any new residential structure, and this is in our, within our general plan, agriculture, conservation, open space element, Ag 5-2.2, no portion of any new residential structure shall be located closer than 100 feet from the site of agricultural operations. And again, greater distances may be required. Hypothetically, let's say the optimal distance that's determined is 150 feet. Could residential structures be placed in the remaining 50 feet over and above the 100? In my opinion, yes, they probably could, dependent upon certain given conditions. But absolutely not within the minimum 100-foot buffer. And I think that's the clarification that needs to be made. Your question this evening is, are residential backyards and associated accessory structures such as sheds and garages an allowable use in the agricultural buffer overlay district? In my opinion, the element that I just read, I'm sorry, not the element, but the criteria that I just read in the general plan basically prohibits any residential uses within the minimum 100-foot buffer. So I don't see how we could put anything like a garage within the minimum 100-foot. Could it be after that? Possibly, yes. The second question is, what exactly is considered storage? And I think that may have been maybe some conflicting language within section E-4. And what I would state in context with the other examples that are given within that particular element or section is any kind of storage that might be consistent with, and I'll just throw out some examples that I think might be appropriate. Let's say a community garden storage shed might be appropriate. A water pump shed might be appropriate. A storage structure for city maintenance equipment might be appropriate within that particular area. Or even a roadside fruit and vegetable stand might be appropriate within that section. But I don't see anything that's going to lend itself as being appropriate within the minimum 100-foot buffer that would be particularly privately owned or particularly part of a particular individual residence, because it seems to be disallowed in the general plan. The second question states, must the 20-foot landscape strip be immediately adjacent to the 80-foot buffer area, or can it be placed anywhere within the 100-foot buffer? In looking at this particular item, again, I think it's important that we look at the optimal buffer, which may or may not be 100 feet. It may be more than that. So I would encourage staff to talk to any applicant and say, you know, what's going to actually work here? And it doesn't, we don't start at 100, but what's going to work? What's going to be the optimal buffer? My opinion is that flexibility should be used when applying this requirement. I think that particular statement is probably somewhat rigid. There may be certain instances, for example, new residential units that are being proposed across the creek from agricultural properties, which may prove to facilitate effective buffer design. In other words, the landscape may be deemed appropriate as what's adjacent to the creek as opposed to being necessarily next to the the new residential units. So I could see some flexibility in that particular area might be appropriate. Although it should be noted that typically it is not the desire of growers to place trees in close proximity to crops due to crop damage from birds. That seems to be a comment that I hear from some of the growers, that they really would prefer to have some distance. But flexibility within that particular item, I think, might be appropriate in certain places. Hopefully that helps direct staff from my specific opinion. So thank you.
Councilmember Reynolds.
I disagree with the whole program for a couple of reasons. Number one, I live with it, I work with it, I deal with it. And if you're an agricultural operator and you can't get along with your neighbors, you need to change your mode of operation so that it'll work that way. A 100-foot buffer is going to do nothing but cause problems in certain areas with pests, and as I've stated prior. As a good example, I think along Cherry Avenue, you have some of those parcels that abut some agricultural land, and maybe those parcels are only 120 feet deep, and you're going to expect the owners of that property to give up 100 feet of that so they can build a 20-foot skinny house in the back of it, and that's not right. You're absolutely taking the property rights and downzoning it and taking the money out of their pocket. It's just sad that it has to come to this as far as I'm concerned. We've gotten along for a long time without this problem. And as far as pesticide drift goes and whatnot, your operators are not going to put pesticides on where they're going to drift within 100 feet. 100 feet doesn't mean anything if the wind's blowing. You're going to have dust, you're going to have noise and everything else. So the whole program is just a way to downzone somebody's property and confiscate it so they can't get the optimum dollar out, in my opinion. So I cannot support it in any form. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have to agree with Councilmember Reynolds. It is a sad state of affairs when we have taken a look at trying to protect one side of our community and we lose recognition of the other side of our community. We have potentially two areas that are affected here. One is certainly new development, but we also have existing residential. And the way this interpretation could go could affect existing residential. I'll go back to Teresa's comment about the preference was. Well, if we get to a point where we have an ordinance or an interpretation of the ordinance and then we have a commission with a preference, it's my belief that the residential will be affected, existing residential will be affected, because somebody will come up and say, well, no, it shouldn't go on the inside towards the 100-foot. It should go on the outside. Well, the street's there, so I guess you can't do it. So we have some issues with that. The comments were made actually from both sides of the discussion in public hearing tonight about financial hardship. Well, who's right? Financial hardship is a process for both sides. You have the farmer who doesn't want to stop farming, so it creates a potential financial hardship. But you have what I consider the taking of land, which is a financial hardship for owners and developers. It's easy to say that these are all big subdivisions and it's big developers trying to put big projects in. And certainly there may be some projects that are bigger. But we're also talking about a lot of small lots, small parcels, as Councilmember Reynolds indicated, that may only have 20 feet left after the 100-foot is taken into consideration, especially if they're trying to develop a new property. A new parcel. We have a letter here from the Aikidas concerning the AG Japanese Welfare Association, who's talking about their small piece of property over on East Cherry, which basically will become almost useless because of the 100-foot buffer, depending on where it's put and how it's structured on that piece of property. It appears to me that we're not discussing here the right – we are discussing the rights or wrongs of the 100-foot buffer, but we're really not talking about that ordinance because that's in place and that's not the subject tonight. But I do want my feelings known on that. Now, getting back to the specifics for tonight, if we're going to place into if we're going to have a 100-foot minimum buffer, then we need to make it as compatible as possible for both sides. And to me, that means allowing, for one, I want to make sure very specifically that any existing structure can be expanded within the 100-foot buffer. That's a residential structure. Two, that garages, storage sheds are allowable within the 100-foot buffer. That that the 20-foot depth of landscaping can be placed anywhere on the buffer as to how it affects the project or the property that's being considered, because we have to look at both sides of the question. And the question is, how do we benefit the farmer if there is a 100-foot buffer, and how do we benefit the property owner that's being, in essence, asked to give up 100 feet of their property? Well, if we can use, put the 20-foot the 20-foot landscape portion towards the farmland, make 80 foot of it available for some non-residential use, and by that I mean non-sleeping use, non-cooking use, but the garage, the storage, the backyard. I mean, we have today all kinds of manners for developments going in where you have to sign off that you recognize all the existing restrictions placed on your property and the issues around you. We have that with airports. We have that with all kinds of other subjects. So there's no reason that any new development can't provide documentation that says you're aware there's farmland across the street and you're buying into that process, so don't worry about it. We have to find a way within this buffer requirement to satisfy both sides of the question. And that's what's important to me because, you know, yes, if we're going to do a large development and we can find a way to squeeze it a little bit and make it a little bit better and the buffer's a little tighter, that's fine. But we need to recognize the smaller projects, the smaller properties, so that they're not having what in essence is a take of their property without financial benefit. And so I want to make sure that, at least from my point of view, that the buffer is used as much as possible for some of these other reasons, the garage, the structures, the remodels towards the buffer, and, again, the potential for a backyard in that. As long as the individuals are signing off, they're aware of the liabilities, I see no problems with it. And I agree with, again, with Councilmember Runnels, if the wind's blowing the right direction, 100 feet is certainly not going to be enough to protect anybody. And we have enough of those issues. Adam, you've been around. You know the issues. Farming has changed drastically in terms of pesticide and how it's handled. And so to try to take these properties away from people who have either invested in them or sat on them for 25 years or 50 years, I think is unconscionable on our behalf, and we should allow them the most use that we can within the policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me get back to, I guess, the principal issue here, and that is that what we have been attempting to do through the general plan, through the development of our agricultural policies, which include the definition and the further development of our buffer zone policy, is in essence to do as several of my colleagues have indicated already. And that is to try and manage the urban and farming interface. This is not a new challenge for us. It has been in place for quite some time, and in fact, throughout California, as the staff report has indicated, And I would like to, first of all, commend staff for putting together a pretty comprehensive staff report here. The reason why I refer to the staff report is because within it are roughly 15 different sample, or I shouldn't say sample, they are exact policies from various counties and I think a couple of cities. And so when I indicate to you that what our challenge is to manage that interface, this is a challenge that other jurisdictions throughout California have also undertaken. If we look at some of those policies and we evaluate them based on the conversations that have occurred this evening, I go right down the line and look at what some of them are in terms of buffer zones and transition areas. And so although there are qualifications for lesser distances, and I recognize that, but we look at what Councilmember Dickens was referring to a moment ago as a minimum or a starting point. And so we look at ranges from places like the city of Davis, which starts out at 150 feet, city of Napa, 80 feet to 120 feet, city of Ontario, 100 feet. City of San Luis Obispo does not designate a distance, but they talk about unique situations and determining appropriate distances based on individual situations. San Luis Obispo County, 200 to 500 feet, depending on the type of crops planted and pesticides used. Monterey County, 200 feet, starts there and then goes to various ranges. Santa Cruz County, agricultural buffer of 200 feet from the property line placed on the non-agricultural land. No activities are allowed within the buffer except farm, public utility, access roads. So that's sort of an extreme. El Dorado County, 200 feet. Mendocino County, 200 feet. Sacramento County, 300 to 500 feet. And the list goes on. Tuolumne County, which is number 14, prohibit construction of new residential non-agricultural buildings resulting from development closer than 200 feet from the boundary of a parcel classified as high-value agricultural land or agricultural land of local importance. The setback may be reduced by the planning director with the concurrence of the Agricultural Advisory Committee. I read that because it highlights a particular aspect that I wanted to underscore. I think if I were to summarize all of what has been provided in this staff report, I would say that our focus on 100 feet here is pretty liberal, particularly with the flexibility that is being proposed as relates to existing development. So I think the approach is reasonable. And I guess that's the test for me. Is it reasonable? And based on what I see existing in other parts of the state, I believe we're approaching this in a more than reasonable manner. The Mayor Pro Tem brought up a good point, so did Councilmember Reynolds, with regard to the orchestration of needs from both sides. I believe this ordinance does that. I believe there's enough flexibility in there to achieve that. As far as the specific issues before us this evening, and that is the interpretation of allowable uses and also the placement of a 20-foot landscape strip, here's my position on it. I think the definition of residential use, and there's a parenthetical note in the staff report that says associated accessory structures such as sheds and garages, excuse me, so on and so forth. The test for me is the degree to which those particular structures or those particular activity areas will, in fact, encourage human occupation and human activity. And if it is, in fact, within the buffer zone, we're talking about new construction only, new units, then I believe those need to be discouraged. Because if they're not, then we're defeating the whole purpose of what we're attempting to do with the buffer zone. I also look at it from the sense of enforcement. And I realize that we have now perhaps some additional local latitude as far as granny units or human occupancy of places like sheds and garages. But we're not a police organization so much so that we can address all of those instances. And certainly there are going to be violations. If you put a garage in a buffer zone and the family is in such a point where they decide to throw a couple of cots out there and relatives can stay from time to time, nobody will know. But yet you have human activity that is elevated within that buffer zone. The same way if you were to plan for a large development with huge backyards that encroaches within that 100 feet. And with a nice backyard, I'm envisioning something like a barbecue pit, a deck, whatever the case may be. You're encouraging human activity within that 100-foot boundary. So if that is our goal, is to create and orchestrate safety between the human population, our citizens, and the farming operation, then I think this ought to be fairly clear. We discourage that kind of placement of these structures and those activity areas. As far as the 20-foot landscape strip, and I understand the whole issue with the attraction of birds and the impact that that might have on crops. But for me, I think there's a different reason or a different approach as to why I favor putting the 20-foot landscape strip adjacent to the development as opposed to adjacent to the farmland. And that is that if we look at some of the development throughout the city right now, specifically along Branch Mill Road, the attempt was to provide a barrier, an immediate barrier, adjacent to the homes. Now, I'm not saying that what we see out in Branch Mill Road where it turns off of Cherry is the best landscape median. That's not how I would envision it. But I think the concept is sound. What you're attempting to do is provide, I believe, some form of a landscaping shield that is in close proximity to the home, not a distance away. And that in and of itself can provide some form of screening. So I think just from a design standpoint, it makes more sense to me to have that landscape strip immediately adjacent to the development itself as opposed to next to the farming operation. I think once, we're at an interesting juncture right now because we've put these policies in place and now we're getting close to kind of operationalizing those policies, which means they are going to be felt within the community. And there's always, I think, a bit of apprehension when we begin to impose these kinds of things for the first time. I believe, again, that once we get into it, once we work with the parties, and I think that's the key, and I know that we're going to have a test case here very soon, and the applicants have been extremely cooperative, trying to work with us in around this 100-foot buffer and being creative, and I applaud them for it. They've done their research and their homework, and hopefully we're going to be able to get through this, and it'll be a good test case and a good model. So those are my views on this issue. I think it can be done, and I think once folks understand the sum and substance of this ordinance, that it's going to work out. And I don't believe I don't look at this as a taking. If it is a taking for the city of Arroyo Grande, then it's a taking for hundreds of other jurisdictions that are in the state right now that are trying to deal with the same thing through similar policies. Okay, those are my observations. If there are no other comments.
Comment, Mr. Mayor, if I may.
Sure.
In some of these counties that you mentioned here with a 300 to 500 foot buffer over in the San Joaquin Valley, I think it should be noted that they still apply fertilizer and pesticides by aircraft, and I think that's the reason why they haven't stretched out as far as they do. And that's not the case in Arroyo Grande anymore.
Well, that's true, but there are also counties here where I believe there are smaller agricultural parcels that are not in the valley, as you refer to.
That's true.
And we still find distances that exceed what we're proposing. So, again, I think it's just the test of reasonableness. And before I – thank you, by the way, for bringing me back to that. I know this is not the forum for it, and perhaps it could be a subsequent discussion. But in looking at these 15 different policies, I see reference, just as in our policy, to an ag commissioner, an agricultural advisory committee, other ag committees that are in a review process that have a, how shall I say, an opportunity to kind of ministerially evaluate issues such as buffer zones and provide input and recommendation. And I'm not so sure that something like that wouldn't be appropriate for us at some point, where we have an opportunity to seat members at large, and we also have an opportunity to seat people from the agricultural community. I see a real potential here for us to be able to mediate some of these issues before they become so contentious. So, you know, this again, this is not the time to recommend it, and certainly we can't take action on it. But I think some form of a sounding board, since we are putting in place some fairly significant long-range agricultural policies, would be appropriate for us at some point. Okay, with that, if there's no other discussion, I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I'm unsure whether is staff looking for a motion on this particular issue, or are you just looking at consensus and interpretation of the current policy?
A motion would be helpful to give them a discussion. Seems like there's a little different views, and it would also would probably be helpful on the two questions to take them independently, establish a motion for each of the items that we had asked for feedback on.
Yeah, and the reason why I would ask for a motion that addresses those issues that are on page 4, 1, and 2.
Well, Mr. Mayor, I would, on the second question, because I'm looking at the alternatives on page 8 that staff has laid out for us, I would move that the council direct staff to allow flexibility regarding the location of the 20-foot landscape strip within the 100-foot agricultural buffer, with a preference of keeping the landscape strip as far away from the agricultural operations as possible.
Okay. Were you going to include allowable uses, clarification of that in your motion?
That would be the second motion.
Our suggestion was
trying to do it in one, if we could, or did you want to?
We thought it actually might be simpler to take them separately. But
okay, that's fine.
Negative.
All right, we have a motion. Is there a second?
A discussion? How do we define flexibility? Is that going to be at the discretion of the Planning Commission? Will that be at the discretion of the Community Development Director?
Ultimately, it's the decision maker who's going to determine exactly where it goes. I'm assuming this is going to be part of the actual submitted plan. and so it would be incorporated into whatever designs the applicant had in mind, subject to the approving authority's approval.
I'll second the motion.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
I'd just like to point out that I think that the problem is, and the staff is facing, that our current policy is actually fairly rigid and it places it very specifically. And I think that in certain instances there may be beneficial elements that could be adding that flexibility would be important. So.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Runnels?
No.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin?
No.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right. I have a motion on allowable uses.
I'll take a stab at it, Mr. Mayor. In regards to the allowable uses, I would move that that we would direct staff to not allow any residential uses within the minimum 100-foot agricultural buffer area and require the buffer area to be maintained by either a homeowners association, maintenance district, or dedicated to the city, as proposed by staff.
For new construction only?
Exactly, for new residential units as laid out in the section 16.12.170.
Did you want to comment, Teresa?
Yes, if I may ask for a clarification, is the motion interpreting that specifically garages and backyards are part of that residential use?
In my motion, that would yes include the restriction of yes backyards and garages within the minimum 100-foot buffer.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other clarifications? We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Any further discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Dickens.
Yes.
Councilmember Costello.
Yes.
Councilmember Runnels.
No.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin.
No.
Mayor Ferrara.
Yes. Thank you, gentlemen.
Take five, sir. Take five.
Okay. We have a request for a brief recess, so council will recess for 5 minutes. Okay, we'll call a meeting back to order. We've had a request, and I believe it's a reasonable one. If council concurs, we'd like to set aside 9C for a few minutes and take 11A so that Patrick can kind of get this over and done with and be on his way. Is there any objection to taking that item out of order?
Fine with me.
Okay. I think we're set then.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the City Council. In July of 2003, the city entered into a memorandum of understanding with a local chapter of the Service Employees International Union that includes a provision that the city will provide a pre-retirement death benefit to those employees on January the 1st, 2005. In order to provide that death benefit, we must amend our contract with the Public Employees Retirement System. Under the current contract, if an employee dies before retiring, the surviving spouse receives a lump sum cash payment that's equivalent to the contributions made by that member into the PERS system. This pre-retirement death benefit will provide an option to the surviving spouse where that spouse can elect to receive a monthly retirement payment instead of the lump sum payment, which is actuarially more valuable to the spouse. There's also an additional cost to PERS and therefore to the public agency, in this case the city. For the current fiscal year, because it's only a six-month period, the cost of the city will be about $4,700. In subsequent years, it will be twice that, or about $9,400. In order to amend our contract with PERS, staff has submitted a resolution of intention and an ordinance, which must be approved by council in order to proceed.
Okay. Does that conclude your report?
That concludes it, yes.
All right. Are there any questions or clarifications on the staff report?
None.
Okay. Hearing none. This is not a public hearing, but once again, it is an active agenda item. If there are any members of the audience who would like to comment on 11A, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. Okay, seeing none, we will bring it back to the council. Councilmember Runnels, why don't you kick this one off?
I have no problem with this, Mr. Mayor, and I think that rearranging the death benefit for the benefit of the spouse is probably the wise thing to do. Well, I can support it as submitted.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Likewise, Mr. Mayor, I don't have any issues with this particular agendized item. It's an appropriate modification, and I'm willing to move forward as presented.
Thank you. Councilmember Costello.
I agree we should move forward with this. I think it's a good idea, and it's well worth the limited additional cost to the city, and I suggest we go forward.
Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I viewed this as cleanup of a contract that we are already into, so in essence, we don't have much choice because we've already agreed to this, so I support the op.
Thank you. I support it as well and concur with the statements that have already been made, and with that, I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I would move an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande amending the contract between the City and the Board of Administration of the Public Employees Retirement System.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin.
Yes.
Councilmember Runnels.
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens.
Yes.
Councilmember Costello.
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Yes. Thank you.
We have a resolution.
Okay. There's also
the resolution of intention.
The resolution.
I'm sorry. Mr. Mayor, I would move approval of a resolution of intention to approve an amendment to contract between the Board of Administration, California Public Employees Retirement System, and the City Council, City of Rio Grande.
Second also.
Motion and a second on the resolution. Any discussion?
Mr. Mayor, do we need to authorize your ability to sign on behalf of the city as well?
Yes, I believe we probably should include that in the motion.
So I would include that in my motion.
Second, agrees.
Okay. All right, so we have a slight amendment. Motion maker endorses that amendment. We have a second. Any other discussion? Roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin.
Yes.
Councilmember Runnels.
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens.
Yes.
Councilmember Costello.
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Patrick. That will take us back to item 9C. This is a continued public hearing, consideration of development code amendment case number 03-008. Proposed ordinance amending the zoning map and portions of Title 16, so on and so forth.
Good evening again, Mr. Mayor, Councilman. This is a continuation of the proposal that was discussed on September 28th, including revision of the zoning map and land use regulations concerning commercial, industrial, and office districts. Again, this is for consistency with the general plan as required by state law. And we have two items to address tonight. One is the ordinance, which includes revisions for the map and the development code. And then the design guidelines and standards are proposed by resolution. The proposed zoning map was discussed last time with the various districts being proposed as mixed use except for the regional commercial district. And again, these do exclude the vicinities of the village and traffic way. Some issues were brought up at the last meeting, and those included possibly adding language to the ordinance or guidelines giving further direction regarding maximum height standards for East Grand Avenue, for buildings on East Grand Avenue. A potential reduction in the proposed maximum building size in the office mixed-use district, and potential modification or removal of a conceptual graphic that was included in the proposed design guidelines and standards. Additionally, staff has had discussions regarding density provisions in the highway mixed-use district. As proposed, live-work units are allowed, with the density being determined through the discretionary process. That's by recommendation by from the Planning Commission. And this is because the proposed highway mixed-use district is, of course, proximate to Freeway 101 and the commercial nature of the district. The Planning Commission did discuss at one time, and the many discussions they had regarding this proposal, a density provision of up to 20 dwelling units per acre. And this was in regards to a different configuration of districts. Some alternatives, if the council wishes to take another look at the density provision for the HMU, would to possibly include multifamily housing as an allowable use for affordable housing projects, and or multiple family housing in conjunction with a mixed-use project, or allowing standalone multifamily housing similar to that which is allowable in the office mixed-use district. The multiple family housing for affordable housing would be is an option to allow potential development of the a property that's currently owned by People Self-Help at Barnett and Cornwall Streets. The Planning Commission recommends that the council adopt the resolution for the design guidelines and standards and introduce the ordinance amending portions of the zoning map in Title 16. If there are any substantial modifications that were not previously considered by the Planning Commission that are desired by council after discussion, it is recommended that the proposal be referred back to the Planning Commission for additional recommendation. And I'll conclude there. I would be happy to answer further questions, and I have further information regarding the discussion items already brought up or any questions you have concerning the proposal.
Are there questions or clarifications in the staff report? Councilmember Costello.
Thank you. Teresa, is there, if we were to go to maximum on multifamily residential projects up to 20 units per acre, and that would be subject to some sort of a bonus for low-income or moderate-income, what would that boost that 22 and still stay under the ceiling we have?
Well, the densities being proposed in all of these mixed-use districts are exclusive of affordable housing densities that are allowed by the housing element, and those vary in terms of the type of affordable housing that may be proposed.
Hypothetically, though, what would be the maximum bonus that would come to something that if we were to give it the 20 dwelling units as the ceiling now, and they came back and had the maximum possible, what would we see it go to?
I believe that would be, see, if it's 25 dwelling units per acre, they can go up to 32, so it would be somewhere in the vicinity of 29, 28, 29.
Okay, thank you.
Any other clarifications? Councilmember Dickens.
Teresa, along the same lines, are you asking us this evening to look at the different alternatives provided on page two in the staff report to identify allowable density provisions for the highway mixed-use district.
As the Planning Commission recommends at this point, there is only the density allowable for live-work units, and that's on a case-by-case basis. But we've received a letter from Mr. Leonard Grant and in acknowledgement of the parcel owned by People Self-Help, there are a couple of locations that may be appropriate for residential use, either as an affordable housing component or not, as the council directs.
My confusion comes in, and I would agree with you. I think that those particular locations would lend themselves nicely to an affordable housing project. With that in mind, with the alternatives that you provided for us on page two, what would be the difference with the three different alternatives that you provided for us in conjunction with those particular concerns on those in that area?
For example, on page two of the staff report, bulleted items toward the bottom of the page, an alternative may be to allow multifamily residential projects for affordable housing projects only, and then that could be any density you prescribe, but typically would be 25 dwelling units per acre. Another alternative is to go ahead and allow multifamily residential projects in conjunction for affordable housing and in conjunction with a mixed-use project that would keep the integrity of the commercial district intact by ensuring that there would be a commercial component of any new development. And then the third alternative is just given as an example of allowing multifamily housing, for example, a standalone multifamily housing project, and the density here is recommended to be slightly lower in acknowledgement of the nature of the highway mixed-use district. These are not your only alternatives. There are three that would be consistent with the rest of the proposal.
So as the ordinance, as it's designed currently, the applicant on the particular property on the corner of Barnett and Cornwall, thank you, would not be allowed to do an affordable housing project. Is that correct? Without a commercial component? Or as it's written now, they wouldn't be allowed to do an affordable housing project at all?
Well, as is existing in our current code, without this proposal, nothing would be, no residential use it would be allowed in the highway commercial district.
Okay.
As proposed with this ordinance, residences only in the conjunction with live work units would be allowed. So these are possible amendments to be considered to the proposal.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mayor. Councilmember Reynolds.
Teresa, has there been any calculations run on our water supply if we go through with 8 or 10 of these multifamily projects with a bonus density involved in it? Or is that premature?
The water usage associated with higher density was considered in the program EIR for the general plan update in 2001. And a subsequent environmental review document was prepared for this particular proposal, but nothing in the proposal exceeds what was examined to be allowed for in the 2001 general plan update.
Okay, thank you.
Teresa, I have a couple of questions and clarifications. On page three of three of the staff report, I just wanted some interpretation here. Said it should be noted that personal services restricted uses, including tattoo parlors, pawn shops, and check cashing services, are not permitted except in the trafficway mixed use and highway mixed use districts, where they may be considered subject to conditional use permits. Therefore, the existing uses established prior to these regulations will become legally nonconforming. Can you clarify that a little bit? Are we saying that subject to a CUP, these things could be permissible in the trafficway mixed-use corridor?
Yes, the trafficway, and these are this is an existing category that's been adopted for the village and trafficway areas, and in the traffic mixed-use district, personal services restricted is potentially allowable through discretionary review. And with this proposal, since the districts are very similar, we are proposing for it to be potentially allowable in the highway mixed-use district.
Okay. The other comment that I have, are you asking here for preferences on alternative language as indicated on attachment one regarding height? Is that also something that we can determine, that you're asking for a determination this evening?
Yes, since it was brought up at the last council meeting, I just included a couple alternatives for your review in attachment one. The alternatives for ensuring that there's no potential abuse of maximum height provision of up to 40 feet that is possible for large lots over 20,000 square feet in the Gateway mixed-use area and Fair Oaks mixed-use district. The alternatives or amendments that you might want to consider include allowing that for mixed-use projects only, which would essentially further restrict that possibility of that height, or include some additional language in the design guidelines and standards as presented in attachment one that gives examples of when such a height might be appropriate. For example, at a key intersection on East Grand Avenue for a corner building that could signify a landmark building. There are other alternatives you may wish to consider, including modifying the height limit.
Okay, well, I like the language that you've, the alternative language that you've put in item two in attachment one. I like that a lot better than the potential of looking at 40-foot massive structure. Okay, those were all my questions. This is a public hearing. And if there are members of the audience that would like to come forward and comment on 9C, this would be an opportunity.
Good evening. Thanks for the opportunity to come speak before you. My name is Leonard Grant. I live at 2366 Willett Way in Arroyo Grande, rural Arroyo Grande. And I am the developer for a housing project, a multifamily housing project on Barnett Street across from McDonald's, between the McDonald's parking lot and the freeway off-ramp at Grand. And we entered into this purchasing this project 9 months ago. I'm an architect, I currently worked on that project, or worked on that project for another developer as well, who eventually dropped out of the project because of the sloping nature of that parcel. It's a very difficult parcel to develop without retaining walls, probably impossible. But I still thought it was a great opportunity to bring a maybe a more creative housing project in. At the time, I spent quite a bit of time going through several pre-apps with ARC, ASAC, and the Planning Commission to look at alternatives for the project. We started out with a higher density project, closer to, I think it was 18, 19 units, which would be close to 25 units to the acre. Eventually, we settled on a project of 9 units plus one very low affordable housing unit. So 10 total, but as a density would be calculated, 9 be about 16 units to the acre plus the affordable unit. So we purchased a property based on that, based on talking to Rob Strong and having many meetings with him. Then I was contacted about a week ago, and Rob let me know that there was a glitch, that the that the multifamily was left out, and that he asked I write a letter and also come to the meeting to try to encourage the alternative of allowing a straight multifamily housing project in that highway mixed use zone. And so that's what I'm doing. I believe it's a great use of the land. It'd be difficult to develop that property for a typical fast food establishment, in that you would be having quite a few retaining walls and a lot of fill brought into the project, and the traffic issues are somewhat difficult there as well. I hope you consider that. I think it's a very creative project and creative design. I think that's a way I think that we need to develop the limited property that's left. I hope you consider that, and I hope you allow for the straight multifamily development and perhaps with affordable housing as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to come forward and comment? Okay, seeing none, we'll close public comment on 9C. Bring this back. Let's see whose turn it is. Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess attacking this piece at a time. If we go to attachment one, in terms of the potential for 40 feet, I don't have any particular problem with seeing a 40-foot limit being included in this in specific instances. If we're going to try to go for mixed uses that incorporate residential uses along with some sort of commercial application, we're going to end up with three-story structures, and I think that may well need to go to 40 feet in the appropriate locations. I would be mindful of problems with massing and with how the proposed project might fit with things that are around it. But I have no particular problem with a 40-foot ceiling in limited places. In terms of adding in the multifamily residential projects, I think that we should bring multifamily projects into the HMU Highway Mixed Use District. I don't think that's a bad application. Again, we're looking for creative ways to bring in affordable or something approaching affordable housing in our community. And I think that one of the only ways that's going to happen is in multifamily types of structures. I would prefer them to be a mixed use rather than simply a multifamily residential project, although I don't think I'm dead set against multifamily projects going in. I think that we do want to see commercial applications in these districts. So I guess I can be flexible enough to think that we could allow multifamily residential projects up to a density of no more than 15 dwelling units per acre. But I'd rather see mixed units, mixed proposals that have a commercial aspect as well as the residential on top. I think that the standards that have been presented to us are an excellent job. I commend staff, Planning Commission, and the community on what it's taken to get to this point. A design guideline and standards are a good document. And I have no particular objection to altering that one graphic that we had. I don't care either way. I mean, it can be changed or not. That doesn't make that much difference to me in terms of what the guidelines should have. But I think that we've got a lot of good work that's come into play here. And am I missing anything else that you wanted clarification on?
Did you want to address maximum building size, allowable maximum building size right now?
Yes, thank you. Yes, the issue of the hospital district overlay. I believe that's Exhibit B. Attachment 1. Right, yes. I think that I would recommend that we go to a 50,000 square foot maximum building size standard, but we do need to protect the potential for possible expansion for the hospital, and I think that the overlay district is an appropriate way to address that. So I can support that and go forward with that. I think that in terms of the size of the project, I think 50,000 square feet is probably an appropriate maximum for this district. As long as we do put that overlay district in and leave some room for expansion for the hospital, should that become necessary in the future. I believe that answers all your questions. So thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Runnels.
Well, considering, Mr. Mayor, thank you, considering in some of these areas we're getting down to where we have a limited amount of real estate to work with, I don't have any particular problem about having mixed use and some commercial and residential mixed in with it because it'll make a good fit. I would hesitate to say, though, that a big, massive building on a corner like we have a couple of them can be out of place if there isn't something to back them up. And I certainly hope that when the housing element gets put in place down in Cortland that softens that bank building up a little bit because it looks pretty big. But, you know, we need to proceed with this. We're down to a limited amount of dirt that we're playing with, so let's move forward with it.
Thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm going to tackle the multifamily use within our highway mixed use area, and I think that we should be allowing flexibility, specifically with Mr. Grant's letter, and I think that the People Self-Help Housing Projects that is in that direct vicinity, we need to have the flexibility to accommodate for that specific need. I think it's going to be, for those sites, going to be developer driven in regards to what's appropriate. And as Mr. Grant had mentioned, that it's maybe ill-feasible to do anything other than multifamily residential on that particular unique site. And I think that we need to allow him to bring a project forward for us to evaluate. There's certainly, traffic issues and other things that we'll need to look at once a specific project comes forward. Yet, I certainly would like to have that flexibility within our ordinance to allow for that. I'm not certain that that we need to have it specifically mixed use. I would actually like to have the flexibility and provide for the language in allowing the multi-use residential projects. And I would say that it really, in this particular district, needs to be affordable housing use. And I would even go and support a density of up to 25 dwelling units per acre for that particular use, since we would be looking at those types of bonuses in our typical housing element as written. So that would be my first. In regards to the other issues with Attachment 1 and the language added to the ordinance for a maximum height, I think that 40 feet is appropriate. I think that we've got an example of a three-story unit in Grover Beach, actually, that I recently was able to go to an open house that fits very nicely in that particular neighborhood. It's certainly something we're going to have to look at to see the size and scale and how that would work in any given proposal within the city, within these districts. But I think allowing that type of three-story flexibility is important. And as far as the maximum building size, I believe the proposal is 50,000 square feet maximum, but then given the flexibility within the overlay district for the medical use is definitely appropriate. So I believe those are answers to most of those questions. Mayor, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First, I'd like to thank you for bringing back some solutions to some of the questions we asked last meeting. I'll take the alternatives on Attachment 1 in order so that I don't get confused. We're talking about the higher height on lots larger than 20,000 square foot, so I wanted to clarify that. And I have no problems with the potential of 40 feet if it's in the right place, and as has been mentioned earlier, that it was done with the concept that it will not be overmassing or in an area that would be inconsistent with other dwellings that were already there. So I would say on alternative one there that I would like to leave in the 40-foot potential for mixed use. In the it may apply to commercial or mixed use projects. As far as number two goes, I have no problems also with the maximum height of the buildings not to exceed 35 feet, except if there is a design feature, and we've already seen that in some of our newer buildings, and I do believe that they will blend better once there is other buildings around them. In terms of maximum size, I agree with the statements made in here that we should reduce the maximum size to 50,000 square feet, with keeping in mind that we want to allow Rio Grande Hospital the opportunity to increase their site if necessary, so that we should allow a larger standard for, as mentioned in here, in the OMU D2-2 overlay district. In terms of the highway mixed use, the concept of higher density there, again, is specifically Mr. Grant's letter, as was mentioned. I think that that is an excellent opportunity for us to bring in additional low-income housing. And if we can look at that as a I would also be agreeable to 25 units per acre there. Did you want to say something? Okay. I have no problems with that, and I don't know. From my standpoint, I don't think it needs to be mixed use in that spot. I do have a question, though. As the 100-foot ag buffer been taken into consideration? Because that does back up to ag in that area, so it will have to be considered, won't it? Teresa?
This would be on the north side
across the street. So.
But it's on the north side. I thought it was on the south side. I'm sorry. I was confused.
And that's do you want to finish? I had one comment I did want to
go ahead.
And that's I want to make sure there's no surprises later. I think staff agrees with the direction of trying to go with more flexibility there because we're not sure what exactly would be most appropriate. But that particular site, staff does have some concerns regarding the housing proposal. That site is right on the freeway. And so we just have some concerns on whether that's going to be a quality site for somebody to house there versus it does seem to be an ideal site for commercial being right on the freeway. So we don't have any problems with the flexibility and working with the applicant and seeing what he comes forward with, but we do have some concerns whether, you know, how quality of a living environment that might be for housing development on that particular site.
Okay. Can I clarify then that so I can visualize it in my mind? We're talking about across the street from the McDonald's parking lot. I guess it would be west of the ARCO.
Right next to ARCO.
So across the street from McDonald's, next to the ARCO, adjacent to the freeway. Okay, so I was confused because I was thinking across the parking lot on the other side of Grand. That's a narrow piece of property, now that I think about it. But I still... with the proper sound barriers, I don't see that there's an issue there in terms of residential, low-income residential. In fact, that area is already somewhat low-income residential, so it probably would blend in with that. So I have no problems continuing with that same philosophy. And I would go to maximum density if we can, from my standpoint. All my other comments were made at the last meeting, so I have no other comments concerning the design guidelines or the issues, and I can support moving forward with these changes.
Thank you. I'll sort of go in reverse order. The whole issue of flexibility, I think, looms large when we're talking about a parcel this size and the location that it's in. And certainly, freeway noise is going to be a factor. I like the comment that was made in terms of being creative. And if ever there was a particular parcel where creativity needed to be applied, it's this one. So the degree to which we can move forward, keeping in mind the needs of the applicant or the owner, and also the needs of the city, I would support that as far as density, whatever that density turns out to be. I at this juncture, I would be very reluctant to state a maximum density because once we get into the planning stages, the whole issue may shift a bit. So the degree to which, I'll go along with my colleagues, whatever the majority is, but I think with a caveat that we may well run into some issues that we haven't anticipated, and so the degree to which we can sort of keep the door open here and still accomplish what everyone needs to accomplish, but there is going to have to be a degree of ingenuity, I think, and some design magic applied to that particular parcel. I like the concept of work-live projects, and if that's a potential for that type of a location, I think that would be something that I would support. Since it's in the staff report, and I don't mean to raise this issue, it's not really one of the issues that we're going to be discussing, with the exception of the fact that we've now expanded this to highway mixed use, but again, on page 3 of the staff report, with regard to pawn shops, check cashing services, and tattoo parlors, not permitted except in the traffic mixed use area and highway mixed use districts where they may be considered subject to CUP. I just want to state for the record that I'm not going to support a pawn shop. I'm not going to support a tattoo parlor anywhere in the city, particularly not in traffic way. So the application, as far as I'm concerned, of a CUP permitting process, particularly in the traffic way mixed-use area, it's far too close to the village and far too close to schools and everything else. So I just want to state for the record, since it's in the report, that I would not support that should it come up in the future. With regard to the height potential, I still have concerns about 40 feet. And an observation was made by Councilmember Runnels about the Santa Lucia Bank building. I happen to think that bank building looks pretty darn good. And also the fact that the senior housing in the back, I think, had a height of 38 feet. But I believe the qualifier there is the fact that it's in the rear of the lot, that and it was built into the side of the hill. So in terms of the appearance, which is the building mass itself, it has been diffused simply by virtue of its location. The other big factor for me is that it's off the street. The last thing that I want to see along Grand Avenue, and I understand that that we are encouraging retail on the bottom and perhaps multifamily on top, again, live-work units. The reference was made to the three structures in Grover Beach, and if you look at those things head on, they're articulated in their design. They appear to be broken up, and if you look at their building mass, it's smaller in terms of the building envelope. And I'm not certain what the square footage is, if it's 20,000 square feet or not on those lots. But my main concern is a large structure that has a significant frontage on the street that is 40 feet tall. I don't believe that's in the best interest of what we're attempting to accomplish. I also believe that we can promote residential uses above commercial retail and not have to go that high. If you look at Santa Lucia Bank, and it was already pointed out that the an architectural feature takes that up to, I think, 36 feet. So we're talking about a building mass potentially that is 4 feet higher than that, and perhaps with a more severe frontage along Grand Avenue or wherever. I don't want to darken a street by the height of a building. I don't want to cut out the sunshine. You know, I understand that we're attempting to increase our density. I think we can do that with a little more of a pleasing approach rather than to exceed what I consider to be a reasonable height. I think we can still, in some areas, get three stories in, and I believe that was what we attempted to do when we established, I think, 35 feet. And there was a long discussion, as I recall, when we went to 35 feet, that we could, in fact, have an articulated ceiling on the bottom floor resident or the bottom floor commercial, and still put adequate residential above it. So I'm still not comfortable with the 40 feet height requirement. As far as the maximum building size standards for the office mixed use, I would support going to 50,000 square feet. I believe that, once again, the manner in which Arroyo Grande Hospital expands, if it should expand, we can look at an exception, since I believe the city attorney at the last time we had this discussion described that as a quasi-public facility, something like that, Tim. And so I believe exceptions can be made in the area of health, safety, and welfare of our citizens. And the manner in which a proposal is forthcoming that expands that beyond what the typical requirement is, I think it can be done in a pleasing way that would consider the use of that facility. So I would be supportive of the overlay. And as far as the depiction, the graphic depiction, if you recall, I really didn't want this to be this big of an issue. And so I would, to be honest with you, I was surprised to see it come back. As far as the hotel is concerned, I think my comment at the time was that I wanted to sort of get away from the penal institution look. And I fully recognize that if we ever get to a point of putting lodging on that particular facility, the whole purpose of that drawing was to incorporate an existing structure. So, and I'm sure there will be other creative designs that come forward other than what we see in the in this sketch. So I wasn't really that concerned about it. But thank you for bringing it back anyway. And I think those conclude my comments.
Mr. Mayor, can I ask a question before we go forward?
Yes.
We've had some discussions about maximum densities, and my understanding is if we go to a density of 25, we're going to have to send this back to the Planning Commission. Is that correct?
From your comments, it appears that the maximum density desired it would be for affordable housing purposes, and that's built into our affordable housing or our housing element in the affordable housing section. The Planning Commission did discuss density potential up to 20 dwelling units as a base density, 20 dwelling units per acre. And this would allow for affordable, if it was, for example, 100% affordable housing to come in at the maximum. If it's 100% affordable housing, then it can come in and reach that maximum you are seemingly desiring. So it's up to you. The Planning Commission didn't discuss this since last March. But I would not think it would be a substantial modification if you went for a base density of 20 dwelling units per acre. I would like a little more clarification if you are proposing that to be allowed for what I'll call standalone multifamily projects or only for mixed-use housing. That would be the only clarification I would want.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, clarifications, comments? Okay. If not, I think what we might do is separate some of these issues. Okay? So why don't we take the issue of density first, and I'll entertain a motion on that. Density provisions for highway mixed use.
I was going to take a stab at a motion that might cover some of them together. I wanted to try that. See what works. I'd move that we adopt an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande amending the zoning map and portions of Title 16 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code, revising the commercial, industrial, office, professional districts, and rezoning the commercial portions of the Plan Development 1.1 and 1.2 districts, Development Code Amendment 03-008, with the amended recommendation to include a 50,000 square foot maximum building size standard with a larger standard in the OMUD-2.2 overlay district, and with the HMU district to include multifamily residential district projects, multifamily residential projects up to 20, a density of up to 20 units per acre, as well as allowing multifamily mixed-use projects with a density of up to 20 acres. And with the 40-foot height potential available only for mixed-use projects, only for mixed-use projects that combine commercial use on the bottom floor and the upper two stories used for retail use,
residential
or residential. Excuse me. Let me change that. With the retail use on the ground floor only, with the upper two stories used for either commercial or residential use, and subject to review that the design of the building is not an inappropriate massing.
Did you want to include language on the graphic illustration?
And graphic illustration. Oh, yes, the graphic and the alternatives for the graphic depiction on East Grand Avenue in the Highway Mixed Use District should be modified as suggested. Does that cover everything?
What about number two?
And number two, going back to the additional height restriction, additional language as recommended in attachment 1.2. On the maximum height of a building not to exceed 35 feet, except if further height accommodates a design feature that can contribute to both the character of the building and the surrounding area. For example, the proposed building at a key intersection incorporating an additional story of a tower or a tower element to signify a corner landmark building.
Well, it seems as though your motion suggests both one and two, if I'm following that.
Yes, it does include both one and two. Right.
Is that acceptable?
Yes.
Okay.
Second.
Discussion?
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion on the motion?
I just need clarification specifically on the highway mixed use and I didn't quite understand the motion maker in regards to the allowable residential projects for multifamily up to 20 dwelling units. Is that would that include mixed use or exclude mixed use?
That includes mixed use. Yes, it's both. Both will be permitted. Both mixed use will be permitted.
Requiring that all residential projects come forth with a mixed use? Is that?
No, it does not have to come forward as mixed use. It would permit both mixed use or simply multifamily residential. Both would be considered.
And would they be, are we talking about a provision of 100% affordable housing at 20 dwelling units per acre?
No, I'm just at maximum of 20 dwelling units per acre. It's up to the applicant to come forward and propose a project, and it would be considered on its merits. If it's going to be greater than that density, it would definitely have to be affordable housing.
Okay. I would ask for some clarification from the motion maker as well with regard to the 40-foot height potential. Joe, you made reference to staff being mindful during the process of building masses. Is there enough clarification in there for, you know, further interpretation of this policy down the line?
Well, any projects forthcoming, and this would apply, this height provision would apply to two of the proposed districts, and any mixed-use project automatically has to be considered by a CUP, and with architectural review as a necessary step. And you have the restrictions that it has to be on a large lot, and it can't be placed directly adjacent to a residential district. And the language in the design guidelines and standards, not only that we have proposed to amend tonight, but also with language in there regarding transitional area. So it would have to step down. If the council feels like that is enough direction, if it only applies to mixed-use projects, again, it would further restrict the number of potential projects coming forward. It's up to the council to determine if they feel that that's enough. It would always be considered in a discretionary application.
I think the missing ingredient for me here, and if we can clarify that, I can move ahead with this. But it stipulates 20,000 square feet, but it doesn't. We're still unclear in terms of the mass of the building, in terms of floor area coverage, of the building envelope itself. So, if we were to insert language into the motion that would. That would also require staff to be mindful of floor area coverage on that 20,000 square foot lot, so that we don't wind up with, again, excessive frontage that's 40 feet high. So that would be the only, I guess, clarification that from a design standpoint, staff also be mindful of floor area coverage on the 20,000 square foot plus lot.
Well, no. Let me ask a question. If we've got, what would the maximum floor area coverage be? Floor area ratio as set. Is there a maximum already involved here? And it shouldn't make much difference then whether, in terms of, if the floor area ratio has a maximum. It doesn't seem to make a great deal of difference to me whether you have a 40-foot or a 35-foot. You'd have the same amount of square footage in terms of used space. The additional height would not change that. However, I think the other features that you've talked about, the not being adjacent to a residential zone, being a mixed-use project, I think for me, I'm comfortable with that, but if you're not, Mr. Mayor, I'm willing to accept.
I'll bring up one specific pending proposal, which is in a specific plan area as a part of the Berry Garden specific plan for the 6-acre commercial area. There is a building element that exceeds the normal 3-story limit, and it's proposed in a mixed-use project, and it's 25% of the basic floor area that goes up. So it's a tower element, and I think what you're trying to do is prevent a full 4-story building being, or a full 40-foot height building, excuse me. The 3-story limit still applies, but you wouldn't be able to put a mezzanine or a roof element that would be totally equivalent to a 40-foot tall building, if I understand what the mayor is suggesting. It's certainly within the range of description here. We're trying to make sure that it's a limited application, totally sensitive to the surroundings, and we haven't put in a percentage of the floor area. The more specific we get, you almost get into a question of where is it going to be. But I think the only example that is currently pending that proposes a element of this nature using a floor area ratio, it's 25% of the other floors that is being proposed as a height exception above 35 feet.
Okay. you know, I don't want to get specific here, but I do want to, you know, stipulate the fact that we're not talking about. I have no problem with tower features. I have no problem with landmark building features. I have no problem at all with the kind of height differential that we see, for example, at Santa Lucia Bank, the new bank building. I think that can be very attractive if it's done appropriately. But if we're looking at commercial frontage along Grand Avenue and we're talking about 50 or 60 linear feet of street frontage and a building height of 40 feet, I have an issue with that in terms of size and scale and mass. And so that's what I'm trying to, I guess, figure out a way for us to make sure that, at least in my own mind, you know, we're able to tend away from that.
Mr. Mayor, if I may, I think that with the discretion that we have, I don't see that as being an issue. And I would agree with you wholeheartedly that we're not looking at putting that type of mass, I'm not, on Grand Avenue. The specific Grover Beach reference that I'm making is actually not on Grand Avenue. It's actually back off, and it's amazing how that particular development blends in with the existing surrounding commercial uses, and is very appropriate. It actually creates a transition from a strictly commercial on Grand Avenue. It's actually behind, and then it flows into more of a residential neighborhood. And I'm using that as kind of something that I see that might have some potential benefits for the city of Aurora Grandy. But yeah, certainly right on Grand Avenue we're not looking at putting that type of mass, and I don't believe that the as written or as proposed that we're going to be restricted or pushed into having that kind of mass along Grand Avenue. So if that's helpful, I don't see that as being taking away any of our discretion.
I would also add that it appears to me to be a design feature. If we're looking at setbacks, corridors, courtyards, we could be dealing with 40 feet without what your concern is, a direct frontage of 50 or 60 feet or 40 feet straight across. So I really think it comes down to maybe a design function more than anything else.
Well, I agree with all of your comments.
How do we put it in here?
But, yeah, and if we have an applicant that comes forth and they read into this the fact that there is license to do exactly what I'm describing that I particularly don't want to see because they have a lot larger than 20,000 square feet, and they meet all the other criteria, and that's their design choice. What mechanism do we have to come back and say, no, you can't do that. You have to break up the frontage. You have to articulate. You have to, you know, do the kinds of things that keep us from, you know, posing this massive structure on a street frontage.
I would take another look at page 8 in the design guidelines and standards. That is the page where we would insert the amended language. And it does discuss the necessity of making sure that there is appropriate articulation and that the building is appropriately integrated, considering adjacent buildings and surroundings. And I think adding an additional language and the other guidelines in this particular section would enable the council or the planning commission to make recommendations on a project or deny a project if the massing of the building is too large.
So you're proposing somewhere in proximity to the sketches that we see on page 8?
Correct. I would put it near the top, right underneath number one.
Okay, so if that type of language can be incorporated both here on page 8 and if the motion maker would incorporate that in the motion, then I'm reasonably comfortable with that.
You need to come up with language then. How about we come up with something that, in essence, says that we wish to avoid a solid frontage and would use design treatment to articulate the building at a 40-foot maximum so that it does not appear, you know, to be massive. I mean, I don't know. Make it sound nice.
If the council wishes...
Is that a quote?
Yeah, that's a quote. Make it sound nice.
The articulation guideline is in there. However, many cities use guidelines that require or in their guidelines suggest that the upper floors be stepped in. And that component could be added into the language if that's...
Building design must include upper floors must be treated with so there is no continuous massing at the 40-foot level.
Okay.
Okay. And does that now become part of your motion?
Yes, it does.
All right.
Second agrees.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
Who's going to repeat the whole thing?
You always got to cause trouble.
I know. Never mind.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. If there's no other discussion, hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Reynolds?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you.
Resolution.
I knew eventually we would get through that.
Moving on to the resolution.
Oh, okay.
I move we adopt a resolution of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande adopting the design guidelines and standards for mixed-use districts as applied to the vicinity of East Grand Avenue and a portion of El Camino Real Development Code Amendment 03-008, incorporating the changes as just brought forward in the ordinance that was just adopted.
Second.
Motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Lubin?
Yes.
Councilmember Reynolds?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes.
Mayor, before we move completely from this topic, I'd like to personally thank Teresa, who has been extremely devoted to advancing the development code exemplary design guidelines and standards, and this is a rather dramatic giant leap forward in the development code amendment. This will basically complete the bulk of the non-residential districts when you act at your next meeting, and then we'll be moving into the residential districts as well. So again, Teresa deserves tremendous acclaim for the accomplishment.
Well, we certainly appreciate it. This has been a long, tough process, and so, Teresa, your efforts are very much appreciated. We're glad we're through this, and it would have been, I think, a lot more arduous had it not been for the way you laid this out. It's a great job. So thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, back to the agenda. We've already addressed the new business item, 11A. There is no continued business. That takes us to item 12, council member items. Are there any? City manager items?
None, sir.
None tonight. Council communication.
One question, if I may, Mr. Mayor, for staff. When is Cortland going to be open?
I
I apologize. I know you had asked me, and I got to get that from our Director of Public Works, so I'll make sure we get that information back to you first thing in the morning.
For what it's worth, just looking at the street looks like it could be open now. I don't know what else is occurring there.
I think they're raising the manholes or something like that.
Are they?
I think it's within a couple of days, but let me confirm that, and I'll get a message out to you.
It's paved all the way through. The curbs are in, and, again, they may be doing some ancillary street work there, but it looks like it's ready to go. Okay, any other council communication?
Yes, as long as we're on streets, I have on Oak Park and Ramona. Now, I recognize it's on the Grover Beach side of Oak Park, but there is still a cement barrier in the middle of the street. I would appreciate if you would coordinate with Grover Beach to have that removed.
It's actually blocking a guy wire.
Yeah, the guy wire has been removed. Yes, it's just the cement block is just there now. And then the question would be, is that going to be restriped once that is done? I'd like to follow up on that. Thank you.
Okay, any other council communication? Staff communication? Anything tonight? Okay, that takes us to item 16, community comments and suggestions. Any member of the audience would like to come forward, comment on any item? No takers? We'll close that. Takes us to item 17, adjournment.
So moved.
Great. Good job.